Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today, we're embarking on an exploration of Kurdish culture as it existed, well, before modern times, roughly up to the 18th century.
That's right. Our aim is really to unpack the key aspects of this historical period.
And we'll be drawing from scholarly research to try and understand the unique tapestry of Kurdish life, particularly in their mountainous heartlands.
We'll look at how Kurdish identity and even the idea of Kurdistan evolved over time.
Yeah, shaped by geography, those crucial tribal structures, and of course, the interactions with powerful neighbors like the Ottomans and Persians.
The sources we're using, they tend to paint a picture of autonomous Kurdish principalities.
And resilient social systems, too, alongside these really vibrant oral traditions that flourished in what was, well, a very dynamic and diverse region.
So where should we begin? Perhaps with the earliest foundations.
Let's do that. Thinking about those deep historical roots in the highlands, maybe stretching back millennia.
It's fascinating, isn't it? We find these faint echoes in antiquity. There are mentions, for example, of tribes in ancient Mesopotamia, like the Gudi.
And the Carduchy Xenophon ran into them, didn't he, around 401 BCE?
He certainly did. And his account describes them as, you know, a fierce, independent people living in really rugged terrain.
A characteristic that seems to stick with the region, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And then a bit later, you have the Serti, mentioned as slingers in the Zagros Mountains in the 2nd century BCE.
Now, the sources are careful, aren't they? They warn against drawing a straight line from these ancient groups to modern Kurds.
Exactly. Direct lineage is debated, heavily debated sometimes.
But the theme, the recurring idea of these distinct, fiercely independent mountain communities, that seems pretty consistent over millennia.
It really does suggest a deeply ingrained cultural value, something that continued to define the region.
And then, by the 7th century CE, with the Islamic conquests, the term Kurd starts showing up more in the records.
Yes, though initially, it often seems to have had a socioeconomic meaning, maybe referring to nomadic groups on the fringes of the empires.
So it's a gradual shift from these early mentions towards a more concrete ethnic understanding.
Precisely. And that brings us to the medieval period, roughly the 10th to 13th centuries. Some scholars call this a significant Kurdish interlude.
Right. And this is where things get really interesting, because you see various Kurdish tribes actually establishing their own states, independent or semi-independent ones.
It's quite remarkable the number of these early dynasties. You have the Hasanwe Hides around Kermanshah and Dinawar.
The Marwanids in Diyarbakir.
The Rawadids in Azerbaijan, the Shaddadids in parts of Armenia and Aran. They built the Manushir Mosque in Ani, remember?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And the Anazids near Holwan. It really shows a dynamic, politically active Kurdish presence.
It's more than just scattered tribes, then. This interlude, even if fragmented, it sets a precedent, doesn't it, for self-governance?
A powerful precedent. It left a legacy of independent action in the collective memory, you could say.
And they weren't just nominal rulers. They had real power. Military strength based on their own tribesmen.
Definitely. They commanded their own armies. And don't forget the later Hazaraspid dynasty in the southern Zagros and Luristan, showing this pattern continued.
And the absolute peak, perhaps, is the Ayyubid dynasty in the 12th and 13th centuries.
Founded by Saladin, who famously came from a Kurdish family, their sultanate was huge, covering a vast area of the Middle East.
The memory of those dynasties, especially the Ayyubids, must have been incredibly potent for later Kurdish leaders, a real source of inspiration.
No doubt. It underlines that there was this substantial period of Kurdish self-rule and influence long before the modern era people usually focus on.
These weren't just brief moments either. These dynasties lasted for generations. They left a real mark.
And it's also worth mentioning, around 1150, the Seljuk Sultan Ahmad Sanjar actually formally recognized a province called Kurdistan.
With its capital at Bihar, that's a significant official acknowledgement.
It is. And you also see the establishment of Kurdish quarters, Haradakrad, in big cities outside Kurdistan proper.
Places like Aleppo, Baghdad, Cairo, Damascus.
Even Jerusalem, Hebron, Gaza. It suggests integration and influence in the wider Islamic world, not just isolation in the mountains.
Okay, so fast forward a bit. 16th to 18th centuries, the Ottomans and Safavids are the big players now. Chaldiran, 1514 seems like a key moment.
A real watershed, yes. And it's interesting how Kurdish chieftains navigated this new reality.
Many aligned with the Ottomans, didn't they? Hoping to keep their autonomy.
It looks like a strategic calculation, playing the two big powers off against each other, or at least aligning with the one that seemed to offer the better deal for self-rule.
So Kurdistan becomes this contested borderland, right, between the Sunni Ottomans and Shia Safavid.
Exactly. And out of this dynamic, you see the rise or perhaps the solidification of these Kurdish principalities, the emirates.
Like Botan, Hakkari, Badenen, Soran, Baban in the Ottoman sphere.
And Mukri, Ardalan, more aligned with the Persian sphere. They functioned as buffer zones, largely running their own internal affairs.
And this is the period of the Sharafnama.
Crucially important. Completed around 1597 by Sharaf Khan Bidlisi, himself a Kurdish mir. It's the first big history of the Kurds, detailing the dynasties, the territories.
An invaluable source, giving us a Kurdish perspective from that time.
Absolutely. Even though it was written in Persian, likely to reach a wider imperial audience.
Then comes the Treaty of Zuhab in 1639. That sounds like it had major consequences.
It really did. It essentially formalized the division of Kurdistan between the Ottoman and Persian spheres of influence.
A division that would last for centuries and deeply affect the Kurdish people.
Yes. While the system allowed for some self-rule in the Emirates, it also embedded this division. Kurdish fortunes became tied to imperial interests.
A constant balancing act to keep any autonomy.
Right. Though sources suggest that even with the formal border, Kurdish elites maintained connections across it. Cultural and political ties weren't totally cut.
And these regions weren't just strategically important, they were economically valuable too.
Definitely. Ottoman Kurdistan, places like Diyarbakir and Erzurum, contributed significantly to the imperial treasury. That economic value is another layer to consider when thinking about why their autonomy was tolerated for so long.
Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Grijbash Hannah.
Excellent timing.
She's got the chai for us. That smells good today, Hannah. Let's have a taste.
Pause.
Oh, yes. This is perfect. Really nice balance. Not bitter at all. Just the right amount of sugar. And I think I taste a hint of cardamom. Lovely. Just what we needed. Always brightens up the recording session. Thanks, Hannah.
Very refreshing.
Okay, back to our exploration. We've sort of set the historical stage. Let's dig into the social fabric now. The structures. Daily life.
Well, the absolute foundation, you have to start with the tribe. The Esheret or Ishira.
The core unit of society, especially in rural and pastoral areas.
Absolutely central. And leading these tribes were the chieftains, the aga, or sometimes the sheikh, holding significant authority.
And it was a layered system, wasn't it? Not just one big tribe.
Exactly. You had the lineage, the barak or mal, then the clan, the haz or taif, and the tribe was often a confederation of these clans.
And people could be absorbed into tribes, too. It wasn't totally fixed.
Sources suggest so, yes. Outsiders could be incorporated over time. Tribalism really permeated everything in agrarian and pastoral life.
And these tribal leaders, along with religious figures like Sufi sheikhs, they kept their influence even after the big emirates declined later on.
They did. They remained key figures in local power structures and social organization. The Sufi orders in particular were important for social integration, sometimes even leading early uprisings.
Within that tribal structure, the family unit itself, the malbat, the extended family was key.
Very much so. Multiple generations often living together.
And marriage practices reflected that focus on kinship.
Definitely. Arranged marriages were standard, and there was this strong preference for marrying within the lineage, specifically patrilateral parallel cousin marriage.
Marrying your father's brother's daughter or son.
Right. It was a way to consolidate family ties and, crucially, keep property and resources within the lineage.
Makes sense. Bride wealth was important, and customs like levirate a widow marrying her husband's brother helped keep things within the family line, too.
And while this practice, lineage endogamy, strengthened the immediate family and consolidated resources, you can argue it might have also reinforced tribal divisions.
Made it harder to build broader political alliances, perhaps.
Possibly. It's a complex dynamic. And inheritance laws usually favored males, especially regarding land, which also tied into these marriage patterns.
Now, what about how people live day to day? Nomadism seems like a big part of the picture.
Pastoral nomadism was certainly a defining traditional lifestyle for many Kurds. That seasonal migration, the kosar,
moving with sheep and goats between the high summer pastures, the Zoma or Yala, and the winter lowlands, the Jermayn or Kwishlak.
Exactly. But it's important to remember most Kurds also practiced some agriculture. It wasn't strictly one or the other for everyone.
So nomads and settled farmers often existed side by side.
Yes, and often in symbiotic relationships, trading animal products for grain, crafts, things like that.
Though not always peacefully, I imagine. Competition for land and water.
Could certainly lead to conflict, yes.
Yeah.
With governments, with settled populations, tribal leaders often had to step in to mediate.
But settled life was significant, too. Villages, towns?
Absolutely. Places like Bidlis, Amida Diyarbakir Sulaymaniyya, which was founded later in 1784. These were real urban centers with considerable populations, markets, artisans.
So a portion of the population were city dwellers, part of that urban culture and economy.
Definitely. Though, as some sources note, periods of intense conflict, a sort of war economy, could disrupt urban growth and push people back towards a more tribal, self-sufficient life.
Okay, let's talk about women. The sources seem to present a really nuanced picture, maybe different from what you might expect.
It's quite complex. Some sources, including later observations reflecting earlier norms, suggest Kurdish women, particularly in tribal or rural settings, had relatively more public visibility than women in some neighboring societies.
Like not veiling as strictly, participating in work, dances, even warfare sometimes.
Right. European travelers also commented on this perceived freedom of association between men and women. There are even documented instances of women acting as tribal chiefs or rulers.
That's striking, but it wasn't universal.
No. Shorif Khan Bidlisi, writing about the ruling classes, mentions polygyny and suggests women were generally excluded from public life and direct state power.
Though even he noted exceptions, didn't he? Women who ruled effectively after their husbands died, praising their male-like abilities.
He did. And you have later figures like Lady Adela of Halabja, or much earlier, someone like Asanath Barzani, a 17th century Jewish Kurdish woman some consider the first female rabbi.
So it really varied based on class, lifestyle, nomadic versus settled and maybe regional customs.
It seems so. Nomadic life often required more shared labor and public interaction. But underlying all this, the sources agree traditional culture was fundamentally patriarchal.
Especially clear in things like inheritance lays favoring men.
Exactly. So it's a picture with many shades, not easily simplified.
Let's shift to the political landscape again, focusing on those emirates. Their semi-independence is such a defining feature.
It really is. From the 15th century up to the mid-19th, you have these numerous Kurdish principalities flourishing, especially, as we said, during the Ottoman-Safavid rivalry.
Ruled by hereditary mirs or begs.
Who enjoyed considerable autonomy internally. They handled their own justice, revenue collection, and commanded their own military forces, mostly tribal levies.
And the Ottomans often formally recognized this autonomy, right?
Yeah.
In return for loyalty and military support.
That was often the arrangement. We mentioned some key ones. Botan, Hakkari, Badinan, Soran, Baban in the Ottoman sphere, Mukri, Ardalan in the Persian. Harfnavi is our guide here again.
And internally, the Mir had to be quite skilled politically, balancing the interests of different tribes under him.
Yes, it required careful management. And the urban centers within these emirates, Cizre, Sanandaj, Sulaymaniyya, Ahmadiyya, often saw cultural and economic activity under the ruler's patronage.
But they weren't unified. There was fragmentation.
Significant fragmentation. The sources highlight how the principalities were almost always divided and entered into rivalries against each other. Think of Baban's rivalries with its neighbors.
So despite the divisions, these emirates were still important cultural centers.
Absolutely. They fostered cultural development. The courts of the Mirs attracted poets, scholars, musicians.
Leading to distinct regional cultural expressions and even helping develop written forms of dialects.
Precisely. Baban became associated with Sirani literature, Botan with Kurmanji. Think of Emede Zani and Memuzin. The Ardalan Emirate was a center for Gorani literature.
He also contributed to architecture, urban development, like the founding of Sulaymaniyya.
So they were much more than just administrative units. They actively shaped regional culture and language, even if that also reinforced dialectal differences.
And their relationship with the Ottomans and Safavids was the defining political reality.
Completely. After Chaldiran, most emirates in Anatolia and Mesopotamia were incorporated into the Ottoman system, usually negotiating for autonomy.
While others like Ardalan, Kelhor, Sometimes Baban and Mukri aligned with the Safavids or tried to remain independent.
The empires relied on them as buffers and for military muscle. But loyalty could be fluid.
Emirates might switch sides to try and get a better deal or more autonomy, like Baban sometimes did.
Exactly. The degree of autonomy wasn't fixed. It fluctuated with imperial power and the emirate's strategic value.
And the Treaty of Zuhab locked in that division between the empires,
solidifying imperial influence. So it was a system that allowed some self-rule and cultural expression, but it was inherently unstable.
Because of internal rivalries and dependence on the empires.
Right. And ultimately, the centralizing reforms of the 19th century brought this era of emirate autonomy to an end.
But the memory persisted.
Very much so. The memory of these independent emirates became a key element in later Kurdish nationalist thinking.
Okay, let's explore the spiritual dimensions now. It sounds like a really diverse religious landscape in pre-modern Kurdistan.
It really was. You had these ancient faiths coexisting with Islam in its various forms, plus the pervasive influence of Sufism.
Before Islam, the belief was likely some form of Western Iranic pre-Zoroastrian faith.
That's the understanding. And elements of that ancient layer seem to have survived in syncretic forms within Yazidism, Yarsinism, and also Kurdish Alevism.
Tell us about Yazidism.
Okay, Yazidism is a monotheistic ethnic religion. Its roots are seen in ancient Iranic traditions, but it also clearly absorbed elements from Islam, Judaism, and Christianity over time.
They believe in one god, Exweed, and seven holy beings, the chief being Tawus Melek, the peacock angel.
That's right. And unfortunately, Tawus Melek has often been misunderstood by outsiders as representing Satan, which has led to terrible persecution over the centuries.
Their traditions, like strict endogamy and belief in metempsychosis, reincarnation, make them quite distinct. And Lalish in Iraq is their central holy site.
Yes, the tomb of Sheikh Adi ibn Musafir. He was historically a Sufi figure, and his followers developed Yazidism into its unique form. Their sacred texts were primarily oral for a long time.
And Yarsinism or Alihak?
Another distinct faith, mainly associated with Kurds. It was founded or reformed by Sultan Sahak around the late 14th, early 15th century.
Their core belief is in God manifesting in successive human forms, Mazariyat.
Yes, with figures like Ali ibn Abi Talib and Sultan Sahak himself considered primary manifestations. Key tenets include the transmigration of the soul, Dunaduni, angelology, and often an egalitarian ethos.
Their main holy book is the Kalam-e-Saranjam.
Correct. And like Yazidism, its origins likely lie in interactions between Sufi groups and older Iranian beliefs.
What about Zoroastrianism itself? Was it still actively practiced?
Its historical dominance in the wider Iranian world is clear, but continuous, organized practice among Kurds in the later pre-modern era seems less evident. The pre-Islamic faith was probably related, sharing roots rather than being identical to Sasanian Zoroastrianism everywhere.
Though echoes might have persisted culturally, and modern nationalists sometimes emphasize it.
Yes, but widespread practice seems to have declined after Islamization.
Which brings us to Islam. It spread from the 7th century onwards.
Yes, with the early Muslim conquests. Figures like Jaban al-Kurdi are mentioned as early converts. Mass conversion happened mostly under Caliph Umar, though there was initial resistance.
And the majority became Sunni Muslims.
Overwhelmingly Sunni, mostly following the Shafi school of law, though some Hanafis too.
But there were also Shia communities.
Yes, particularly in areas bordering Iran and in parts of Iraq.
And Kurdish Alevism, how does that fit in?
Alevism is complex. It's generally seen as a syncretic faith, drawing on Shia Islam, especially reverence for Ali, but incorporating many other elements.
Developing in Anatolia from the 13th century among Turkoman and Kurdish tribes, often with pre-Islamic traces.
That's the picture. Influenced by Sufi mystics and later by Safavid Iran. The Ottomans were often suspicious of them, labeling them Kuzulbash or redheads due to perceived Safavid loyalties.
They developed into quite distinct, somewhat closed communities over time.
Often, yes, preserving their own rituals and doctrines guided by hereditary holy families or okak.
So a real mix of Islamic traditions. But Sufism seems to have had a particularly deep impact across the board.
Profound and lasting. For many ordinary Kurds, Islam was experienced primarily through Sufi teachings and the guidance of local sheikhs.
The Sufi orders, the tariqas, were key social institutions.
Absolutely, especially the Qadiriyya and the Naqshbandiyya, which became very influential from the 15th century. Their lodges, the zawiyas, were centers for worship, teaching, charity, mediation.
The sheikhs held real social and even political power. sometimes rivaling tribal chiefs.
They certainly could, and significantly, many of the early Kurdish uprisings in the 19th and 20th centuries were led by Sufi sheikhs, showing their influence.
Sufism was clearly a major force shaping society, identity, even politics.
Undeniably.
And what about formal education? Were there centers of learning?
Yes, the madrasas. They emerged as important centers after Islamization. The first Kurdish one might have been in Hamadan back in the 950s.
Teaching Islamic sciences, preserving knowledge.
Exactly. Quran, Hadith, law, Arabic grammar, logic. Saladin is even said to have reformed the madrasa system, perhaps including Kurdish instruction.
Kurdish instruction? That's interesting.
There's evidence suggesting some teachers translated Arabic texts into Kurdish to help students understand better. It shows an early awareness of using the vernacular.
Was education valued?
Sources suggest a cultural emphasis on it, an aspiration for families to send at least one son to a madrasa. Female scholars existed too, though less commonly, and learning also happened in mosques, primary schools, kutabs, and Sufi lodges.
So localized networks rather than big centralized systems.
Largely, yes. Especially in the autonomous Emirates, education was tied closely to religious scholars and Sufi networks.
Let's switch gears to language and literature. A complex linguistic picture, you said.
Very much so. Kurdish is a northwestern Iranian language, but it's really a continuum of dialects. Kurmanji in the north, the precursors to Sorani in the center, various southern dialects.
And Zazaki and Gorani are related, but distinct languages, spoken by culturally Kurdish groups.
That's the linguistic consensus, yes. Oh. And the differences between the main Kurdish dialects themselves, Kurmanji, Sorani, southern, can be significant. Communication wasn't always easy between, say, a Kurmanji speaker from the north and a southern Kurdish speaker.
Which would reinforce regional identities and literary traditions.
Exactly. Reconstructing early Kurdish is tricky because we don't have many written texts before the 16th century. We rely a lot on comparing Kurdish with other Iranian languages.
Given that, oral tradition must have been incredibly important.
Paramount. For centuries, it was the main way culture, history, values were transmitted. Epic poetry, folklore, songs, stories. It was a rich and vibrant tradition.
And the Dengbej were central to this, the bards.
Absolutely revered figures. They were the keepers of collective memory, the performers of epics. They played a crucial role in preserving the language and culture through sung poetry and recitation.
And the most famous epic is Mem-Uzin.
Considered the national epic, Emadezani gave it its definitive written form in Kurmanji in 1692, but it's based on a much older oral tale, maybe 14th or 15th century.
It's a tragic love story, but more than that.
Much more. It's full of Sufi philosophy, but also reflects on Kurdish disunity, the lack of a king or state. It expresses an early form of collective consciousness, an aspiration for self-determination.
Vinny even used the word Malal, nations, for Kurds, Arabs, Persians, Turks, quite ahead of its time.
Remarkably so. So this oral tradition, especially Mem-Uzin, was vital for cultural continuity and identity when written standards were limited and dialects diverse. The Dengbej were custodians, and the epic was a shared touchstone.
But written literature did start to emerge.
It did, from the 16th, 17th centuries mainly, with some earlier traces. We mentioned the Shirafna, historically crucial but in Persian.
But poets started writing in Kurdish dialects.
Yes. Figures like Ali Hariri, Malaya Sidziri, Fekih Tehran, and of course Emadezyani in Kurmanji. Zani also wrote a Kurdish Arabic dictionary for children, Nubihara Bisukan.
And literature in Gorani was significant, too, especially in the Ardalan region.
Yes. Poets like Kana Kubadi. Gorani acted as a kind of literary language in some areas, and later, the Baban Principality encouraged writing in the dialect that would become Sorani.
So the seeds of written Kurdish literature were being sown even as oral tradition dominated.
Exactly.
Okay, let's turn to other cultural expressions. Arts, crafts, customs. Weaving seems really important.
Hugely important. A very ancient tradition, especially among nomadic and semi-nomadic groups. They wove everything they needed. Rugs, kilims, storage bags, tent hangings.
Using wool from their own sheep and natural dyes.
Primarily, yes, giving those rich colors. Kurdish rugs are known for being robust, often with geometric designs, sometimes with a kind of deliberate asymmetry.
And designs varied by region or tribe.
They did, reflecting local traditions and sometimes influence from neighbors, like Caucasian designs in the northwest, and certain centers became famous for specific style.
Like Sena, modern Senandish.
Famous for finely knotted carpets, intricate patterns like the Harati design, and also a very distinctive flat weave, the Sena kilim.
And Bijar rugs, the iron rugs.
Known for being incredibly dense and durable, tightly packed knots, heavy wool, often bold medallions or floral patterns. Weaving was practical, economic, and deeply cultural.
And what about music and dance?
Vibrant expressions, central to social life, identity. Kurdish music has its own distinct feel, though there are shared influences with neighbors, too.
Often melancholic themes in the epics and ballads, but also upbeat dance music.
That's a good summary. Vocals are key, usually with instrumental accompaniment.
What kind of instruments?
Lutes like the tembur, which is sacred for Yersanis or the Saz. Wind instruments like the duduk or kaval. Stringed instruments like the kamencha. And percussion, the daf used in rituals, and the dahul drum, often paired with the zurn pipe for dances.
And religious music was important, too.
Very. The Yarsanis use the tembur in their gatherings. Yazidis have quals who perform hymns. Alevis traditionally used instruments in their sem ceremony.
And dance, the gavanind or helperki.
A communal activity, absolutely essential at weddings, festivals like Newroz. It symbolizes unity, heritage.
Often danced in lines or circles, holding hands with a leader.
Yes, the surgovend, often waving a colorful scarf, rhythmic steps, shoulder shakes. There are hundreds of regional variations with different steps and rhythms. It's a living expression of community.
And finally, traditional clothing.
Distinctive.
Very distinctive. Silu Berjan Kurduari. Vibrant, practical, with regional variations, but a general aesthetic setting it apart.
What did men typically wear?
Baggy trousers, the shalwar, fitted shirt, often a jacket or waistcoat, a wide sash or cummerbund, pishtend, and headgear like turbans or caps.
And women's clothing. Generally more colorful and elaborate. Long dresses, krass, often layered with vests, elik or jackets, kiwa, sashes, and quite elaborate headgear, gofi, sometimes adorned with coins or beads, anchoring scarves.
Again, with regional variations reflecting tribal identity and local customs.
Exactly. Clothing, like dance and music, visually marked local identity within the broader Kurdish culture.
Let's briefly touch on the economic foundations before we wrap up. Pastoralism was key.
A pillar of the economy. Herding sheep and goats, adapted to the mountains, the seasonal migrations we talked about, it shaped so much.
Providing milk, meat, wool, hides.
Wool being vital for textiles, tents, carpets. Livestock was wealth used in trade for bride wealth. Pastoralism wasn't just economic. It shaped social structure, mobility, even military capacity.
But agriculture was important too.
Definitely. In fertile areas, wheat, barley, rice, lentils, fruits, vegetables. And the relationship between nomads and farmers, sometimes cooperative, sometimes conflictual, was crucial.
Land tenure, likely hierarchical, with elites controlling large tracts.
That seems probable in settled areas, with peasants as sharecroppers or smallholders paying tribute.
And trade. Was Kurdistan connected?
It was at a crossroads, so yes, regional trade networks were active, connecting Kurdish towns to each other and larger centers like Mosul or Kermanshah.
Trading pastoral goods, agricultural products, crafts like carpets.
Right. Urban centers had markets, workshops, and as we noted, Kurdish regions were economically significant enough for empires to value the revenue, often collected via local elites.
Which adds another dimension to that story of autonomy. It was partly tolerated because it was economically productive for the empires.
Until the empires decided direct control would be even more profitable, which happened in the 19th century.
So wrapping up our exploration today, it really reveals a pre-modern Kurdish culture of, well, incredible complexity and resilience.
Deeply shaped by the mountain environment and those constant interactions with powerful neighbors.
From those ancient echoes through the medieval dynasties to the later emirates with their negotiated autonomy, you see this persistent assertion of identity.
And the social fabric, the diverse spiritual world from ancient faiths to pervasive Sufism, the power of oral tradition alongside emerging written forms, the artistry, it's a vivid picture.
The economic foundations rooted in the land also show that adaptability.
This historical context is so crucial, I think, for understanding the legacy and the challenges that shaped the Kurdish experience later on.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it? How did that lack of lasting political unity in the pre-modern era influence later Kurdish aspirations for a unified state?
That's a central question. And what aspects of this pre-modern culture, the tribal structures, the language, the memory of autonomy, the religious diversity, what do you think most profoundly shapes contemporary Kurdish identity?
Something to really ponder as we conclude this exploration in the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.